why do we want it? It's a food. Otherwise, why do we do something? What do we want the food for? So we can enjoy it. That's material life. And with that, there's bondage. With that activity, there's the reaction to that activity. And with the reaction to the activity brings about a mix of things desirable, and a continued journey or birth and death in the mature world. Samsara, repeated birth and death. So chapter 3 is presenting an alternative to that. Again, what's the alternative? Karma Yoga. In the language of our acharyas, they describe it this way. Nishkam Karma Yoga, or Karma Phala Tyag. That's the term. Karma Phala Tyag. Detachment from the fruits of your work. Karma Phala Tyag. How to work without attachment to the fruits of your work. Well, you have to be attached to something. You're going to work, we are accustomed to being attached to the fruits of our work. So, yoga means to connect yourself with something higher than the fruits of your work. Continue with your work. Karma nivadikara state. Mahapalaitri kadachi, without attachment to the fruits of your work. So you have to be attached to something else. Be attached to the Supreme. It's a message of transcendence. That which you become attached to is beyond modes of nature, beyond the influence of karma, beyond material creation. Connect your consciousness to the Supreme as a way of life. That is a message. Then there's stages of that. Have you ever heard the question being asked, or maybe you've thought the question yourself, why are there so many religions in this world? You ever wondered that? Or heard people ask, why is there so many? And there's different ways of answering that. Bhaktivinoda Thakur gives a very nice answer. That which comes from the Supreme is actually one. However, over time, that how that is applied, according to the people that apply it, the modes of nature, proliferate different ways of looking at the same one. And then groups form, and then they clash with one another, and so forth. The message is one. Originally, in time, over time, variety is involved by the influence of the modes of nature. Then another answer, similar to the modes of nature question. Supposing, I've heard this question asked lots of times as a sannyasi, if the goal of Bhagavad Gita is surrender to Krishna, why does Krishna present all this other stuff? This to the goal. Surrender to Krishna. And the answer is, well, some people don't want to surrender to Krishna. In fact, everyone takes birth in this world because they don't want to surrender to Krishna. Raga dvejas mutina dvandva mohina bharata. I mean, all living entities take birth in this mature world because they're overcome by the duality, dvandva, mohina, of Radha and Dvesha. They want to be in the position of an independent enjoyer. And he who is the independent enjoyer, they have Dvesha towards him. They have an attitude. They have animosity. They have ill will towards he who is actually in the position of the enjoyer of everything. I want to be the enjoyer of everything. At least some of the time. I should have the option of sometimes being the supreme enjoyer. Someone else can take their turn, that's okay, we're democratic around here. But you know, I should have my turn too. Run for office of God. I can take my position. So some persons in this world, they don't want to just do one thing, just surrender to Krishna. So what about those people? Krishna is very compassionate. Narayana is very compassionate. He gives some means for gradual elevation. He's loving. He doesn't give other options to confuse people. He gives other options. When they don't do this, then they can do this. If they can't do this, they can do that. Just like 12th chapter Bhagavad Gita. You want full service. Well, if you can't do this. And so, what's being presented in this little section that I'm going to read some verses from is Karmakanda. So, start, you have a pyramid. The pyramid is everybody. The unregulated everybody. They don't have regard for regulation. They don't want to acknowledge some authority above them. So I do what I want. Called hedonism. When I was in college, it was a slogan. Hedonism slogan. If it feels good, do it. That's the, you know, the counterculture that I grew up in. And now they've just, marketing purposes, they've condensed it. Just do it. So out of those unregulated everybody, there's some that recognize, well, wait a minute, I'm receiving so many things, the air that I breathe and the light of the sun and the moon and the nourishment from agricultural production and water, and I'm actually dependent. So let me be respectful towards those who I'm dependent upon. Let me make some sacrifice unto them. So that's the section. It's karma. There's a section of the Vedas, vast section of the Vedas. Over 90% of the Vedas deals with karmakanda. Karmakanda means that you recognize there's some authority above you, you're dependent upon that authority that's above you, and you make offerings unto that authority that's above you. Because you're indebted to them for having received things from them. And you make offerings to them, and there's a procedure or standard of how to do that, given within the Vedas. And ultimately there's a beneficiary, a bhokta, of that yajna, and that's Vishnu. So first is I honor Vishnu, and then I propitiate various devas. I seek the assistance of Ganesh to remove the obstacles in achieving that which I wish to achieve. And I have a qualified brahmana that knows the appropriate mantras and rituals, tantras, and they can assist me in doing this sacrifice. So I approach a qualified brahmana that knows this sacrifice or that brahmana that knows that ritual, and I live my life in a religious way. Karmakanda rituals. I'm just going to read some of the verses directly from Bhagavad Gita, and then we'll come back to this narration part. All of that was just to get us caught up for last night. So I'm going to read from Bhagavad Gita chapter 3. You'll have to look these verses up in your little handheld device. Chapter 3, text number 11 will be about 10 verses, just the verses. Let's start with 10. That's what we discussed last time. In the beginning of creation, the Lord of all creatures sent forth generations of men and demigods along with sacrifices for Vishnu, and bless them by saying, quote, be thou happy by this yajna, or sacrifice, because its performance will bestow upon you everything desirable for living happily and achieving liberation. Unquote. that's what the Lord said. Be happy. Have anything you desire. Just perform these sacrifices. And then, text 11. The demigods, Devan, plural, Deva and plural is Devan. The demigods, being pleased by sacrifices, will also please you. And thus, by cooperation between men and demigods, prosperity will reign for all. Next 12. In charge of various necessities of life, the demigods, being satisfied by the performance of the yajna, sacrifice, will supply all necessities to you. But he who enjoys such gifts without offering them to the demigods in return, it's certainly a thief. Everybody knows, don't be a thief, because it's bad. You're breaking the law. You're a lawbreaker. You're violating the law. You'll be caught and punished. Don't be a thief. Make this sacrifice a way of life. The devotees of the Lord are released from all kinds of sins because they eat food which is first offered for sacrifice. Others who prepare food for personal sins enjoyment barely eat only sin. In text 14. All bodies subsist on food grains which are produced from rains. Rains are produced by performance of yajna, sacrifice, and yajna is born of prescribed duties. Regulated activities are prescribed in the Vedas, and the Vedas directly manifested from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Consequently, the all-pervading transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. That's as far as I'm going. Next 15. So, Krishna is very kind. For those that are inimical towards him, they've got an attitude, a bad attitude towards him. He doesn't feel dvesha towards them. He doesn't feel a bad attitude towards them. We've discussed this already.
Is there any way to know whether or not, you know, on the transaction
that he's leaking out the door from our side or any of the show on the mental side? Samaham Sarvabhuteshu Namme Dvesho Sti Natriya, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. All living entities I have equal regard for. Samaham. Sama. I'm equal. I don't have dvesha, a bad attitude towards others, even they may have a bad attitude towards me. I don't regard them that way. Or those that are kriya, they regard me with a bad attitude. So, he just reciprocates with people, so the people that have this attitude, he's very kind. He provides a means for them to become relieved of the bondage of their karma and gradually elevate it. So here's how it works. There's the unregulated, and then there's those that are regulated by the codes of the Vedas, starting with karma conduct. They're prescribed duties and their ways of achieving desirable things, just as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita here. This is karma conduct. So to perform karma kanda, there's multiple elevating factors. One, it comes directly from the Vedas. And where do the Vedas come from? Narayana. So you're contacting Narayana by accepting the codes of the Vedas. Supposing I wanted to shake hands with Manasi Ganga, but my hand doesn't reach that far. Supposing I put a stick on the end of my hand and a glove on the end of the stick and we did one of those. So we're not directly, but, you know, indirectly. Similarly, when we contact the Vedas, we're contacting Narayana. We're in contact with Narayana. It's through the codes of the Vedas, but the codes of the Vedas come from Narayana, so we're contacting Narayana. So we're by followers, those who follow the Vedas, the rituals and the everything, they're in contact with Narayana, a little remotely, but they're in contact with Narayana. Then, second, in order to perform the rituals of the Vedas, the Karmakanda section of the Vedas, one requires a brahmana. You can't do the rituals without a brahmana. And brahmana means, if they're qualified at least, they're knowledgeable in Brahman. They know transcendence. You contact a person who knows transcendence, you become spiritually benefited and elevated just by that contact. And third, thinking of yourself as independent, which is the way that material life is made up of. America is very fond of independence. Where Americans are firmly attached to the sense of independence, rightly or wrongly. Generally, it's wrongly. So that sense of independence from the supreme is diminished. And the undesirable consequences of false sense of independence. It's just by being situated in basic sacrifices. Even people may not even know what the mantras mean and so forth and so on. You're recognizing a superior authority above you to fulfill the thing that you wish to achieve. Fourth, it elevates one into quality of goodness. Passion is still there. I want. And you fill in blank. You go to the priest that knows that particular one. Passion is still there, but goodness is increased. So all those factors combined gradually lead to more the acknowledgement of the bhokta of the yajna. The bhokta of the yajna Vishnu. And all Vedic sacrifices, it doesn't matter. A to Z, all the different possible varieties of Vedic sacrifices. There's one universally present bhokta of the yajna, Vishnu. The very first mantra that's spoken in Karmakanda rituals is a mantra to Vishnu. Because he's a bhokta of it. It's for him. And the last is this similar. Krishna is saying, within these sacrifices, transcendence is situated. Let's say it the other way. Transcendence is situated within acts of sacrifice. The sacrifice is for something worldly. I want fill in the blank. But transcendence is situated within that sacrifice. So it is elevated. And as one becomes elevated in that way, more prominent than my desires becoming fulfilled, which was initially, the prominent thing, I don't want bondage for my work, but I want stuff. So I go to the Vedas where there's these practices of sacrifice. And gradually my consciousness becomes elevated to the point of doing them for Vishnu. At least, offering something unto Vishnu. Sacrifice unto Vishnu. So then that Karmakanda moves into the position of Karma Yoga. Because this was a question we discussed yesterday evening. What does Karma Yoga mean? For the, at least some portion of the fruits of my work is offered to Vishnu. So then that becomes Karma Yoga. I work in a spirit of detachment, not for the fruits of the work, but for the satisfaction of Vishnu, making sacrifices unto Vishnu. Then, so that's Karma Yoga. From unregulated to regulated to Karma Yoga. Where the interest of satisfying Vishnu becomes awakened. According to what we read just this morning, we read from Kapila Dev's teachings to Devahuti, that sense of servitude and submission is intrinsic within the soul, is of the soul. That's something we need to learn, go to school and learn. It's already there. It just needs to be awakened. And so that person who is a karma yogi may, of course they may not, but they may come in contact with someone who's carrying bhakti in their heart. And if they come in contact with bhakti, then they can move from karma yoga to bhakti yoga. They may not. And so they can continue with karma yoga. And let's do the, let's do the, now it, this is now splitting into two, forks into two. Let's go this way and then we'll go this way. But if they don't come in contact with bhakti, they may continue starting with sakam karma yoga. Karma yoga for the purpose of achieving something. And Vishnu is in the picture, but I want to achieve something. That's the incentive. That's the motivation. Satisfy Vishnu and I get something that I want. In fact, I need. I feel I need anything. As that continues, and by the regulated type of life, the mode of goodness increases, and then one starts to consider, not just this life, but after this life. And if I start to think about after this life, especially in contact with the brahmana, I may start thinking more about the interest of the soul. It's not just this life. It's after this life and then the next life. And what is it that's going on in the next life? Well, it's not the temporary body. It's the soul within. Now, I'd like to learn something more about the soul within. And progressively that becomes Nishkam Karma Yoga. And then study of the scriptures that deal not just with rituals, but Brahman. Knowledge of that which is eternal. I still haven't met a devotee yet. I'm just like going up the yoga ladder. So unregulated, regulated, Sukkam Karma Yoga, Nishkam Karma Yoga, Gyan Yoga. Then I might, my interest may be just Brahman and merging with Brahman. But somewhere along that line of that staircase method, one may have the good fortune of meeting a devotee. And then with that opportunity, the possibility is there to then go to the top rung of the yoga ladder. According to what Krishna says in chapter 6 of Bhagavad Gita, the uttama, or the topmost form of yoga, is madgatena antaratmana. The mind is fixed upon this. Consciousness absorbed. Antaratmana. Shraddhavan, with faith. Bhajate yoma, engaged in devotional service to Krishna. Same yukta tamo mataha. That's the topmost. That's the top rung of the yoga ladder. Now let's go over this way. Supposing there's somebody that's unregulated over here. Or they may be above that. They may be regulated by codes of the Vedas. Unregulated or regulated by the codes of the Vedas. And that person then gradually, by that regulated activity, comes to the position of karma yoga. Or they just stay unregulated. That person comes in contact with the devotee. You know, they receive a Bhagavad Gita or whatever. Premananda was sharing with me. She gets really enthused about things like when student groups come to the temple and there's this audience that they just like blank slates, please write on me. And she gets it to write on them and you explain about Bhagavad Gita and things. So supposing this happened to me once, I went to with Niranjana Maharaj, we were not sannyasis at the time. We were in Boston together. And there was a student from a prep school. You know what that is? Preparatory school. There's public schools for high school. Then there's private schools. Education, they call them in New England prep schools. report. That's a Tory school. Anyway, there was a student that was doing a paper on Hare Krishna. They just chose Hare Krishna. They went and conducted a program at their school. That person became a devotee. Full-time, you know, completed their education. And they just moved into the temple with permission from Ramadan. And just, you know, just the student did. Found out about Hare Krishna, found out about Bhagavad Gita, chanting, and they did it. And they were very happy. Can't be happy. Then after they lived in the temple for some time, they went back and completed their college education. But, you know, they had that training from the unregulated to then bhakti. They didn't go through all that other stuff, just bhakti. And they completed their education and got their job and got married, and they had then a life of devotion. It's very nice, very rewarding. So that may happen. So this is one channel, then another is bhakti. And with bhakti, then right away, so this is the distinction between the yoga ladder and directly bhakti. Prabhupada compares the bhakti process to an elevator. He spoke of the Empire State Building. There's two ways to get to the top floor of the Empire State Building. Staircase and elevator. It may take you the whole day just to get to the top floor. You may have a heart attack on your way all the way up there. So, but they have staircase. They have to have for fire purposes. And then you do the elevator. I don't know if you've ever been in the Empire State Building. I have. There's so many floors, they have to have like three different sets of elevators. One goes up to this floor, then you go across the hall and go up to the next step, and you go to the next, and then you can go to the top floor. You have to go through three sets of elevators. Not one that goes from the bottom all the way to the top. So, the bhakti is the elevator method. You just, you know, press the button and say, I want to go to the Krishna local floor. The door closes, and whoo, you know, you're on the topmost floor, and you walk out, and wait a minute, I'm not qualified. Welcome to, you know, devotional service. And in that realm of devotional service, because devotional service, bhakti is very powerful, it helps make you qualified. Of course, you have to want to become qualified, not just walk around the Krishna Loka. You have to be qualified. But bhakti makes one qualified in a variety of ways. But the essence of that bhakti principle is whatever you do it for Krishna. Now there's an element of karma yoga in that also. There's another well-known verse from Bhagavad Gita. Yat karoshi, yat asnasi, yat shahosi, didasi, yat tapasyasi kamdeya. How's it end? Tat karasho madarpanam. Madarpanam. You do all those things as a form of arpana, as a form of worship of Krishna. You can do that in karma yoga consciousness, or you can do that in Krishna consciousness. Meaning, I can do that with the sense that I don't want bondage of my work, so I do it for Krishna so I don't have bondage of work. And if I do this for Krishna, then I'll get stuff back. I do and I get back. It's not just do it for Krishna. There's a subtext, a little investment calculation involved. I'll give this and I'll get back that. Or, if when the bhakti principle is mature, then there's only one thing, and that's pleasing Krishna. And whatever happens when your life is about pleasing Krishna, it's right in the purport of this. I didn't read the purports. We're in the material world, and it's a place of duality. This is Chicago. When I got here, I said, wow, it's really warm. Is it going to snow tomorrow? I was told, Mara, it's been that kind of a winter. You know, this to that. So whatever it is now, it's going to be something else. Now it's midday. and then it's going to be night, etc. It's a place of duality. Sometimes hot, sometimes cold, sometimes light, sometimes dark, sometimes pleasure, sometimes pain, sometimes honor, sometimes dishonor. Sometimes you don't have something, and then you get something, and then it's taken away. We're discussing in the Bhagavatam section is about time. Time brings things into being. Time sustains things. Time takes things away. Seems cruel when things are taken away. Seems so celebratory when things are given to you. We celebrate people's birthdays. In one sense, you know, it's joyous. In another sense, it's that much closer to death. With every passing year, we're that much closer to death. We're celebrating, we're that much closer to death. Depends on how you look at it. But time is bringing things, so time is an energy of the Supreme Lord that does not act in the realm of transcendence. Time is, we're discussing, time is conspicuous by its absence. Time is eternal. What's that like? What's time that's eternal? It's curious. Jiva Goswami, here's a little deviation here. Jiva Goswami says, in the spiritual world, there's the sense of time, although there's no time, because you can't have events without a sense of time. You know, like here we are, we're gathered together for the program. We were somewhere else before, we're at the program, and then we're going to go somewhere else. And we need passage of time to do that. You need time to have events. So how do you have eternal pastimes? Jiva Goswami said, well, there's a sense of time. It's yoga maya. It's eternal time. Like, you know, Krishna's going out to herd the cows with the cowherd voice. Eternally he's doing that. So there's a sense of passage of time. You follow? Here's another example. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, in the spiritual world, there's a verse. Krishna says, in the spiritual world, there's no need of sunlight, moonlight, or electricity. Everything is self-luminous. You know that? There's no need of sunlight, moonlight, or electricity. But we find that in the spiritual world, there's a sun and the moon, and there's day and there's night. But it's unique, because in the spiritual world, every night is a full moon. Because a full moon is to enhance Krishna's pastime. That's why there's a moon. That's why there's anything. And there's the appearance of the rising and the setting of the sun, although everything is self-luminous. Because it enhances Krishna's pastime. There's no sun like we know of sun. There's no moon like we know of moon. I haven't met anything about electricity in Goloka. Here there's electricity. But interesting, isn't it? Electricity is there described in Bhagavad Gita 5,000 years ago. What is electricity? It's just a transformation of the energy of the sun. That's what it is. How do you get electricity? You take energy of the sun that's stored somehow without going into it. Photosynthesis stores the energy of the sun in coal or whatever, the movements of water. Because the sun evaporates the water, goes up in the mountain, comes down the mountain, and do a hydroelectric power and capturing the energy of the sun, etc. So there's no need of that, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It's just the way that this exists because of that, not that exists, that's the same as this. As above, so below. You've heard that phrase. In the spiritual world, there's day and night, but not like we know day and night. There's the appearance of time, but time is eternal. There's no past, present, and future. It's eternal. Is the sense of things for the purpose of the satisfaction of Krishna. So we can live our life that way, in this realm, where things are in fact temporary. It does get cold in the winter in Chicago, so it does get warm in the summer. There is the influence of time. Bodies do get old and die. But there's no birth and death of the soul. There's no birth and death of activity of Krishna. The life is eternal. So we can live our life that way, that is, be attached to Krishna while you're doing all these temporary things with time and the temporary material energy. You perform your prescribed duty without attachment to the results of the prescribed duty, because the purpose in bhakti, the purpose of the activity is just pleasing Krishna. So, raising children and going to school and going to the office and paying your mortgage payments and, you know, doing all the things that you do. Answering text messages. I was watching this fellow. The plane arrived just yesterday. He was going so fast with his son. I don't know how people do that. Really good guy. Going with his... It wasn't a teenager either, it was an elderly man working out. So, the things that we do, we can do that for Krishna too. Send text messages for Krishna. Not the other time, but for Krishna, we can do. We may deal with the temporary. That's this chapter 3, Bhagavad Gita. And the necessities of life are supplied. So mentioned it there specifically. We'll just do one more example and go ahead. Every living entity subsists on food grains. So where do food grains come from? It comes from the earth, but the earth doesn't produce food grains without rain. And where does rain come from? According to Bhagavad Gita, and the whole of the Vedas, it comes from sacrifice. So you make sacrifice unto Indra, and then you get the rain, you get the food grains, it rains the same life, and then you continue on as you're grateful for the grains that have been supplied, and you will offer to Indra. Indra Yajna. But where does Indra get the ability to provide rain? He gets from the personality Godhead. So just worship the personality Godhead. And Indra's pleased. You know, if he gets a little proud, like it happens with the Govardhan Lila, Krishna's new. Indra's proud. I want to curb my devotees. I want to curb his pride. So he had the Nanda Maharaj worship Govardhana Hill instead of worship Indra. And then it ended up Indra's at Krishna's feet. After really bad behavior, trying to drown all the residents of Vrindavan, including all the cows and Krishna's dearmost friends, Indra lost it. But the purpose of the pastime was to curb Krishna, to curb Indra's pride. So we just worship Krishna. And within that worship of Krishna, everything is situated. Just discussed in this chapter. And then again in chapter 7 and again in chapter 9. Just worship Krishna. And everything is fulfilled. Just like pouring water on the root of the tree, all of the leaves and branches and twigs and everything gets water. Just pour water on the root of the tree. Find the root of all existence and place your tendency for worship and devotion and respect and the harmony of nature, the cycle of life, just apply yourself to a worship of Krishna. And everything else will be fulfilled. Everything else will be fulfilled. The peace and harmony that is desired will actually be fulfilled. What we're implicated by our previous activity, our previous involvement in activities of forgetfulness, of ignorance. So we get our share of misfortune. It comes our way. Due to what's behind there, the past. So a Vaishnava way of life is to continue looking towards the lotus feet of Krishna, continue in the regular practice of not just doing, but specifically fixing the mind upon Krishna while you're doing your chanting, or while you're doing your other duties, worldly duties. Fix your mind upon Krishna, do that for Krishna, in that mood of devotion for Krishna. And everything, necessities will come, and the ultimate goal of life will come. And if we don't do that, attend the class tomorrow morning, we're going to hear about adverse creative activities. There is an option. Don't do that. Engage yourself in creative activities without that consideration of fixing the mind upon the Supreme. And there are consequences in a way of life like that that's undesirable. So let us at least try to fix our mind upon Krishna while engage in our Krishna duties. Chapter 3 leads to action in Krishna consciousness, leads to devotional service. There's progression. Each of us have a different, you know, level of realization. Our trajectory, our spiritual trajectory is different. That's okay. Understand where it's all headed towards. Prabhupada very kindly does that within his purpose, even in this early part of chapter 3. He's already speaking about pure devotional service. That's the goal. So whatever our position is, recognize what our position is, and strive towards that goal. Act according to what our position is, and strive towards that goal. Any comments or questions? I'll compliment you, Srila Dakar, you've been very peaceful. Pretty hard being young, listening to a boring Bhagavad Gita class. Nice talk. Yes.
When you were mentioning about Nishkama Karma or Karma Palatya, you mentioned that it involves being not attached to the fruits of the world. I was just wondering, Maharaj, what is the difference between being not attached to the fruits of the world and not having any expectations? Is both one and the same, or?
No, not exactly the same. Just that was there. They're related, so they're not exactly the same. To have no, the phrase to have no expectation. When we do something, we came here, we have an expectation. We're going to serve prasad, I hope. And there's probably a few other expectations along with that. You know, we're going to hear a message that's going to be elevating to consciousness. So, having an expectation is natural. So, the phrase not having an expectation is most appropriately used when, in the context of your life, that you wish to come to the position of purification of your heart. That's an expectation. And it may happen this way, it may happen that way. It may happen sooner, it may happen later. But, you know, it's an expectation. So having no expectation is, I've got my plan how it's supposed to happen. The purification is supposed to go like this, and like this, and like this, and it doesn't go like this, and like this. I get upset. Because I had my expectation. It worked out in a different way. Or I may have an expectation that the Prabhus here are going to recognize my sincere effort. But supposing I don't get that recognition, didn't meet my expectation, the outcome of our activity should look like this. That's an expectation. It's just Krishna is a controller. It'll come out however he wants it to come out. What's my duty is to perform my prescribed duties in a sincere and prescribed manner. It's going to come out however it comes out. I'll continue to strive to improve how I'm applying myself, hearing the instruction properly, sincerely applying myself to the instruction. That should be my expectation. And how it comes out is up to Krishna. Sometimes people may honor you in a way that you didn't have nothing to do with it. Some persons may come and dishonor you in a way you had nothing to do with it. That's just part of being in the material world. You should expect duality in the material world. If you expect other than duality in the material world, that's a false expectation. You'll be disappointed. So there's some similarity, but it's different than karma palatya. Karma palatya is specific to work that's done to achieve something. And the advice of the teaching of karma palatya is don't make that the motivation for doing prescribed duties. Change that expectation to simply performing prescribed duties without expectation of the result, which you be the enjoyer of the result. It's very specific, karma palatya. Now how to do that, because we're prone to be attached to the fruit. So you have to become attached to something else. Attached to the motive Buddha's of attachment is the wish to become purified. The transcendental attachment is I wish to become attached to Krishna. In other words, this is the mode of passion is I'm doing the prescribed duties because I want something. I want recognition. And I don't get recognized, I'm disappointed. In one sense, recognition is human. We're not impersonalists, we want relations and it's just natural. That which is natural, that mode of passion element that's natural, brings undesirable distress. And even when we get the recognition, what's that happiness? It didn't meet my expectation. Because it's not what real happiness is. You gotta pat the back. 5 gold stars on my report card for, you know, like they achieved something. And then what? Where's that satisfaction? It doesn't satisfy. Karma palatya. Rather change the channel to let me satisfy Krishna channel with this prescribed duty. And then you have a relationship with the transcendental personality. And that becomes what's important to you, that relationship. And acting within that relationship. That's not disappointing. So that's the upside of karma palatya. Yes.
About the destination of the results following the Jnana Yoga or Karma Yoga or Bhakti Yoga. I had a question.
Okay.
My question was, if a person who is following Jnana Yoga, he could not reach the destination, like Krishna, and he's maybe more than half the way. And similarly, a person who is in Bhakti Yoga, he is not able to complete going back to Godhead. So when they come, like, you take birth again, will they, like the person who is in Dhyana Yoga, will they be going to like Mahaloka, or is it coming back to Prithvi Loka?
There's so many variables, you can't just say this or that. There's so many variables. Too many to say. Depends on where their consciousness is at the time of death. That's where they're returning. For the devotional practitioner, Krishna is very clear. There's the one who doesn't complete. There's these two general destinations. They'll attain a heavenly planet, enjoy bountiful life for some time, and then come back and continue where they left off. It's complete bhakti yoga. They'll come back to the earthly planet, take birth, and continue where they left off. Or, that's one option. Then another option is, then the other option is, you don't go to the heavenly planet, you just take birth in a devotee family, and then continue where you left off. And that's preferred, from Krishna's perspective. Just complete your business. For Gyan Yogi, and those situations are also variable. Which heavenly planet, for how long, and which devotee family, and what's the standards, and stuff. So but just the general parameters are there. And for Gyan Yogi, so many things could happen. First of all, where's the Gyan Yogi? Show me one. That's very rare. And depends on what they're attached to, what their consciousness is fixed on.
Like a person who is in like Himalayas or somewhere in remote place, he's doing his dhyana, very meditating, but he couldn't feel that kind of person. Like what I was trying to escape is will they be coming back to Prithvi Loka or Maharloka or Jnanaloka, Tapaloka, like those kinds of destinations?
So, maybe, so maybe not. Depends on where their consciousness is. I understand your question. You're just asking it again in another way. The answer is the same. It depends. You can't make it like it's there. That's it. Those are possibilities. And there's so many other possibilities. And then there's consciousness. The principle of yoga, you'll find this in the final purport of chapter 6. Just fixing the word yoga to anything means there's some element of bhakti. Or there's some element of regard for the personality of Godhead and doing this type of practice or that type of practice becomes Gyan Yoga or Dhyan Yoga or Karma Yoga. Because of some affinity for the Supreme. So depending upon the degree of affinity for the Supreme, there's a different outcome. And then, minus that affinity for the Supreme, there's attachment to something else. Maybe somebody something else is. Adoration. Project. It's very... It's not possible to become free from those things without bhakti. That's the teaching of Bhagavatam. It can become less, but it can't be, the root of it cannot be taken away by Gyan Yoga. So depending upon the degree of that attachment of the temporary. According to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, even the desire for liberation is a material desire, in part because it's definition by negation. Liberation means not this. material. It's not this. So, what's not this? Well, it's not this. Aspiring for Brahman, which is, at least in principle, what Gyanis are looking for. What is Brahman? Well, it's not this. Okay, and what is it? So, the connection with the personality of Godhead, the degree to which that connection has been nourished, is going to determine where the person goes, where the soul goes. And that large part depends upon the association with yourself, and how one has applied oneself to that association. It's descending mercy. It's not just ascending effort, acquiring knowledge. Knowledge alone is not enough. Knowledge is essential. Knowledge alone is not enough. Yes.
So Maharaj, when someone takes that elevator of bhakti yoga, the elevator does go through those stages faster, Similarly, is the person in bhakti yoga, does this exhibit the symptoms of karma yoga and all of this kama yoga? Or
the answer to that can be a very detailed answer. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that different acharyas have analyzed it in different ways. Some say if the sequence goes like this, some say it just happens in reverse, some think it doesn't necessarily happen this way or that way. I'm just making it really simple. So it's different for different persons. Certainly, that relieving oneself from misconceptions and attachments to that which is born of misconceptions, attachments born of tattva de brahma, misunderstanding of transcendence, it's going to manifest in different ways for different people. But they'll have to pass through those, becoming relieved of those misconceptions to get more to Krishna. Whether it happens in this sequence or this way or that way, it can vary from individual to individual. It doesn't mean, for example, it doesn't mean, oh, now I'm experiencing that I'm becoming, free from the fruits of my work. Or now I'm becoming free from the affinity to understand transcendence through speculative knowledge. It's not a bucket over here and a bucket over there kind of thing. Rather, through bhakti process, those things are things that we pass through. Something that I like emphasizing is there's qualities that in order to enter into Krishna Loka you must have. Otherwise, no entry. So part of the bhakta's duty is to develop those qualities so that when we come before Krishna, we're not an embarrassment. We're fit to come before Krishna. So we should aspire for those qualities. That's part of the responsibility of getting in the elevator. We require Krishna's mercy to develop those qualities because otherwise they're not going to develop. But so connecting through devotion with Krishna to manifest those qualities, Krishna can decorate one of those qualities. But then he'll take away the bad qualities and we have to scream when he does. Or protest. When our attachments are taken away, unwholesome attachments, Krishna takes them away and places something much better in their place. You have to trust Krishna to do that. in Krishna's own way, in his own time. Just like this expectation question was asked earlier. Our plan might be something very different than what's happening in our lives. We trust Krishna. What do you think? Do you trust Krishna? Because he'll do it in his own way. He's not going to follow your plan. He had his own plan.
So everyone has a different elevator.
Well, everyone's experience in that elevator is different. It's customized by Krishna. Okay. Wait a minute.
You have something. Right in the same lines, where the devotee has developed those qualities.
The devotee has?
Developed those qualities to become pure enough.
Okay.
So, and when I think of the anthropology, the number of Krishna in the form of death, so is it that if a devotee who's a sadhaka doesn't achieve that perfection, he will not be able to remove Krishna in the form of death? Or if he removes the Krishna in the form of death, he becomes purified? I'm trying to understand that, because of the test of that.
Well, let me ask you a question in response to your question. Where does remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness come from?
From Krishna.
From Krishna. So there's the answer to your question. Within your question is the answer to your question. That is, Krishna supplies remembrance according to his plan. Or let's say his sanction, which is a better word, his sanction. I can give you, so supposing you're, driving a car. And here comes the cars, you know, ready for a collision from the side, whatever you call those things. Side something. Now, there's the reflex of the motor system to like avoid, you know, put on the brakes or pull to the right or whatever you're going to do. And then there's what about the mind going to Krishna? It's not the time of death, but it's the time of danger. And is the mind going to go to Krishna? Well, it depends upon Krishna. And it depends upon how you've cultivated attachment to Krishna. Whether the mind is going to go to Krishna. Maybe give some other examples. Somebody has a serious illness, they're in the hospital. I know a number of persons that are in this condition. And when the light goes out, are they going to remember Krishna or not? Well, it depends on how they live their life up to that point and the intensity of absorption that they have in wishing to remember Krishna. So Krishna can intervene at that moment of death and appear in your thoughts or have you remember him. But it's a life of devotion that is going to determine that, not just that particular moment only. What's your relationship with Krishna like? How much, when you're chanting your japa, are you trying to absorb your attention in the sound of the holy name? The answer to that question is going to be the answer to your question. How likely is Krishna to appear at the moment of death? In your thoughts. Better practice your japa tomorrow morning. You want that to happen. Because I don't remember how many times I've died, but I've been told that the time of death is very painful. Besides the physical pain, the pain of losing that which you're most attached to, the body. And all that's connected with the body, meaning that, you know, the family members may grieve the loss of the departed soul, but the departed soul is going to grieve the loss of those persons that they left behind. So all those attachments. So we have the opportunity now to practice being attached to Krishna while we're dealing with the temporal. And dealing with the eternal. When we're chanting and worshipping and praying.
Yes, ma'am. Then for a sadhaka, you know, who's struggling with a lot of anarthas, it feels a little more discouraging. Yeah. Because
at least we're given the opportunity to go beyond those anarthas. Or have the most powerful instrument has been handed to us. And so I'm trying to recall, there's a Sanskrit phrase in one of the sutras, the Vedanta Sutra. I can't remember the phrase. But it means these activities must be regularly performed. That's why we have mantra, we chant the mantra again and again. It should be, we hear glorifications that just hearing the holy name once are all wonderful things. There's potency in each and every one of Krishna's holy names. We're so dull that we have to chant again and again. But now it's not just numerically, but also qualitatively. The opportunity is there. The sadhaka that's far from the goal has a great opportunity. The means and the descending mercy that goes along with the means. So take your consciousness there rather than, oh, I'm so far from the goal. You can do that. Self-pity, you know, seems attractive sometimes. But it's not going to help you go forward. It's debilitating. So rather, see the opportunity, and according to capacity given by God, you strive. That's the opportunity for each one of us. And gather together in good association, because it will help you. And it's not just a matter of, you know, buying a ticket to go where there's some sadhu sangha. When there is that opportunity, the heart is open. It comes down to how much do we want to be in our relationship with Krishna, after all. Not just, I don't want to take birth again, so Krishna please appear in my mind. Like he's an order supplier or something. It's a relationship. How much do we want that relationship? Which one? There's eight of them. Age is taking away your memory. That's it.
We seem to read everything in Krishna's hands, and as you said just there, it's Krishna, plus Krishna. In the next verse, it says, I know that I'm going to be there. I know that I'm going to be there. So it's like there was a prayer. Please pick me up, and they have placed me as an alternative.
Do you think that's a contradiction? It's a mood of humility. I have no other shelter but you. And I'm so insignificant, I'm just like a particle of dust. Please place me particle of dust of your Lord's feet.
Yeah, so there's...
It's submission.
So there's this anxiety in you, like, you might have the consciousness of Krishna, remember Krishna at the time of death. So that anxiety in you was in that prayer.
That there's... Which element goes in that field?
Anxiety.
No, anxiety. No, humility, not anxiety.
So I thought that is kind of an expression of the same.
No. Humility. You are my only shelter, and I am insignificant. I am dependent upon you. Please kindly keep me in your association and place me as a part of the dust of the ocean. Humility, not anxiety.
So, thank you.
Okay.
in reply to Prabhupada's question, the thing I seem to understand is sincerely desiring, it's up to one's how much his soul desires for Krishna. Krishna is appropriate according to so Maharaj, in trying to remember the instructions, for me personally, I feel I have very bad memory, so sincerely desiring to enhance the memory just to remember the instructions and follow them, is it that Krishna reciprocates if I have that desire? Because I feel on one hand, the bodily memory generally tends to diminish with the as one ages, so... So I feel like am I desiring something which is violating against the way the body functions, something like that. I have some doubts.
The best way to remember an instructor is to be attached to the instructor. When you're attached to the instructor, the instructions become important. Try to just become attached to the instructor or follow the instruction without that attachment to the instructor. Then it's just a mind game. Sometimes, sometimes not. Flickering mind. To get off that platform and get onto the bhakti platform, then remembrance will come. Whatever you're in. Yeah. I knew you'd help me.
That's
why I'm not
reading
the chapter
about the passing
of the teacher. Ah, one of my favorite chapters.
In there, it is said when people are talking how Krishna is equal to everybody.
Yes.
But in the Prabhupada, there's a statement that Krishna is equal to everybody, but to non-devotees, he acts only as a witness side and a creator, but he doesn't speak to them. He only speaks to the devotees because they will not listen to him.
Because the Krishna's position is he's reciprocating. Go ahead.
Question related to that.
Okay.
I personally found that really difficult to do it personally because knowing how kind and loving and merciful Krishna is. So I was wondering when you're not a devotee, what was the intuitive feeling or intuition come from? Is that Krishna's feeling?
Well, Krishna, yeah. Both inside and outside, Krishna's trying to capture our attention. Now, let's go back to the reference that you made. He permits. He observes and he permits. At the same time, you know, there's, what's the word? Intuition is one word, but there's another word. Conscience. Let's take stealing. Someone can become numb to stealing. Just tune out that the message of conscience that it's not good to steal. If someone would steal anyway, they just become prone to stealing. Just like if somebody else becomes prone to do something else. Like a child. They'll do something again and again and again and say, don't do that. They're prone to find something to do it again. Because they're prone to do it again. So behind that behavior of stealing, there's a conscience. That's Krishna. So Krishna is speaking to them. that says that this is good. That's like Prabhupada's example. Why do thieves sneak around at night? They know it's not right. They want to be not seen. So they do it because it's not done. Behind that, Krishna is not revealing intimate things about himself to such people because they're not even hearing him on the, you know, the conscience side, or using your word, intuition. Krishna gives the intuition to the thief. Don't go now. Here comes somebody. Okay, now they pass by him. He's giving that actively. He's supplying that intelligence how to steal, as well as the person, you know, keep the doors locked because there's a burglar, something like that. What I mean to say here is, it's not in an absolute sense, Krishna doesn't speak to the non-devotee. He just observes and permits. He's doing other things. But the confidential things about himself, he's not disclosing. Because they're not inclined to hear it. He's kind. And in fact, you know, like the verse in Bhagavad Gita, it says, Krishna says, you know, don't disturb the minds of the faithless, and Prabhupada explains the devotees do it anyways. Because they know the higher purpose of Krishna, he cares about them. And so they go anyways. And, you know, give transcendental teachings. Because that's what Krishna wants, and the devotees are Krishna's agents. But even from within, the prompt is there. This life of godlessness, and all that goes with godlessness, is unwholesome. You know, please don't continue that. Like a loving parent may say to a child that's doing something that's unwholesome, they'll say it anyway, even the child is going to do that, something that's unwholesome. And even if they say don't do it, they'll still say it, because they're loving parents. Krishna's like that also. The intimate things he doesn't disclose. That's what, you know, that's called Chaita Guru. So he's doing. But on a level that even some basic levels that are responding. He doesn't give for intimate things about himself.
Ask, what is
Sure. Welcome to the club.
So then, when Krishna still speaks to me,
yes. Yes. And the degree to which, and the confidential nature of which, Krishna will speak to you will depend upon your attentiveness. I mean, let's be real here. We hear many, many things that are very intimate about Krishna that's way over our head. That's coming from Krishna, and way over our head, and he does it anyway. And then there's some, you know, down to our level kinds of things, and that's there too. Krishna will continue. He's relentless. Thank God.
Yeah. I have a question on the same chapter, the singing of Vishnu there. There, Sutta Goswami specifically mentions that when Vishnu Dev is passing, he uses the word merging. And in the same Bhagavatam, when Dronyavad is passing, airplane comes, there is no word of merging. So how we understand being Bhishmadeva Mahajan, why that kind of word merging? Because merging is, we don't want that kind of,
I follow your question.
How can we understand that?
It's a different kind. You read very carefully. It's not, Prabhupada doesn't unpack it. But our acharyas do, and it's not, keep reading in further verses subsequent to the one, because I recall reading in that chapter. Same question. Keep reading in further verses. The application of that term is different than Sanyajamukhi. Use the date as a pure devotee, there's no question. So it has to have a secondary meaning besides that traditional primary meaning. It's a rule of Sanskrit. You must take the direct meaning unless it just is inappropriate, and then you must take a secondary meaning. Jiva Goswami describes this. Sorry, it's a little technical. But Jiva Goswami describes this in his Sandarvas. That when we find such things as what you're referring to, taking into account the the vision of the Vyasadeva in trance, he does not describe the process of becoming freed from the material existences, souls are merging into the jyoti of Brahman. He doesn't describe that. So if you find some reference that seems to say like that, you must take a secondary meaning because it doesn't match the message of Vyasadeva's trance. That's chapter 7 of Canto 1, and you're reading chapter 9 of Canto 1. So you must take a secondary meaning. It does have a secondary meaning. He's, you know, the functions of the senses become merged.
Correct. That's what the word said. Mind, body, and speech. Activities merge into Krishna.
So, these are, it has a secondary meaning. The secondary meaning, that's the meaning should be taken, goes like this. Something like this. Krishna is the source of everything, and for living entities to have a gross physical body, there must be also a subtle physical body, and there must also be the controllers of that subtle body, the demigods. This gets a little complicated, or technical, I should say. But so, merging means that facility, the body, both gross and subtle, that the power of them is withdrawn. For devotional service, we engage that power in service to Krishna. If Bhishma Dev is doing this particular thing, because he was departing his body at will, so that was withdrawn. Like pratyahara in the yoga process. Mm-hmm. Withdrawing the senses. It doesn't mean, you know, his arms went into the socket, he showed no arms. It means the power of locomotion, the power of vision, the power of hearing, the power was withdrawn because they were being engaged in service to Yudhisthira to describe to him the duties of a king. And then that time came, and he just withdrew that power, and he was amalgamated or merged. And then it describes other things that he did with his consciousness. Continue reading those verses that follow that one verse. And he was fully conscious, he fixed his mind upon that form of Krishna, on Parthasarathi. So his light was on. He didn't merge with Brahman. His mind is fixed upon Krishna. The power of acting in this world, the power of the senses was withdrawn. And he engaged the sixth sense, or the mind, absorbed in thought of Krishna. Without the usual thing that we concomitantly also do is practical activity. He's mystic. In many ways, he can give up his body whenever he wants. Most people can't do that. So that's what it means. It's the secondary meaning, not this other Sanyajamukti.
It's not like merging and being nothing, but he's
still... Yes, it's not Sanyajamukti. He was withdrawing his senses of the subtle sense of action was being withdrawn.
He's still thinking about love.
Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj.
His power of speech, his power of scent, hearing, his power of smell, power of locomotion, those were amalgamated. They were brought into a silent position, merged. And the mind, and the soul, fully absorbed in bhakti, devotion of one Krishna.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Okay, we think we're done. Thank you very much.
Jai.
Jai. Jai. Jai.
Jai.
Jai. Jai. Jai.